Baltimore then and Baltimore now, 50 years in the economic life of a city. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 30th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. In Baltimore today, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake promised justice for Freddie Gray. Police say they've turned their investigation over to prosecutors who will decide whether or not to file any charges in this case. The violence in that city this week has led to a lot of comparisons to the much larger riots of 1968, April that year, and the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Some of the same neighborhoods in Baltimore were affected then as have been affected now, and in a lot of ways, those neighborhoods never really fully recovered. Marketplace's Amy Scott in Baltimore looks back at what's changed and what hasn't since that long week going on 50 years ago.
In April 1968, Kim Peace was a young girl when Baltimore erupted after the death of Martin Luther King Jr.
I seen people looting and tearing stores and stuff up. I really didn't understand what was going on, but now I know.
50 years later, Peace lives in the neighborhood where Freddie Gray was arrested and where the violence broke out this week. She came out to clean up with her granddaughter. Michael Higginbotham teaches law and civil rights at the University of Baltimore. He says the 68 riots were far more widespread than what happened this week, but the roots are the same.
We're talking about high unemployment. We're talking about poverty, homelessness, drugs, crime, and hopelessness. And that's what were the causes in 1968, and they're the same causes. And the problem is we haven't dealt with that.
In fact, he says the 1968 riots only made those conditions worse because businesses were reluctant to invest. Patricia Fernandez Kelly wrote the book The Heroes Fight about West Baltimore. She doesn't buy that it's fear that keeps businesses away. She says it's generations of neglect.
It is because we have not invested in those neighborhoods. Those are folks who really do not have a loud political voice.
One teacher in Baltimore is trying to give his students more of a voice. At Mount Royal Elementary and Middle School, Baba Olumiji's 7th and 8th graders are writing letters to their city council members. When school reopened after the unrest, he used the legacy of the 68 riots to teach nonviolence.
We thought it was important for the children to see that neighborhoods don't always get restored. And so that no matter how people felt when they were engaged in that activity, they had to understand that now a community has been damaged, perhaps, hopefully not, irreparably.
Now the hope is that West Baltimore won't be forgotten again. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
To avoid making too convoluted a turn here, I'll just say it was a subpar day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Way over on the other side of the country from Baltimore and in a completely different economy, truth be told, there is almost more money than people know what to do with. Silicon Valley is where I'm talking about, where if you are going to go under, you might as well do it fast and just be done with it. That is one of many possible takeaways on the meteoric rise and spectacular flameout of the anonymous social networking site Secret. It was a brief but crazy success during the year and a half or so it was around. It got $35 million from some big names in venture capital. But now the CEO is going to shut things down and give some of that money back to investors. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the story.
Secret allowed users to blast an anonymous message or picture to friends and connections and let them be delighted or dismayed in guessing the sender.
There was everything from, like, everyone be careful, there's a dangerous person who's picking fights, to, yeah, I have a crush on him or her.
That's Max Wolf. He's chief economist at Manhattan Venture Partners, which researches and values tech companies before they go public. He says Secret was really popular with high school and college kids.
At one point, I think they had surpassed 15 million downloads with no marketing budget initially behind that.
But the app quickly ran into issues. Cyberbullies used it as a place to taunt people. Wolf says a redesign made the app look too much like its competitors, Whisper and Yik Yak. Interest fizzled. Key employees jumped ship. Matthew Wong is a research analyst at CB Insights. He says Secret could have tried to reverse course and reinvent itself instead of shutting down. But he says it's hard to get that initial investor excitement back.
This was probably the way to go, and rather than try to take us in a different direction or continue with a company where the chances of success aren't as high as they definitely were earlier.
We could be seeing more of this kind of failure in Silicon Valley, particularly in the app world. Max Wolf at Manhattan Venture Partners says the app economy is like the music industry, where you might have a hit single.
And you put together a really expensive tour, and by the fifth week of the tour, you're playing to no one.
Wolf says at that point, there's probably no need to keep the money the record companies advanced and continue on another 20 cities. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The Chinese banking system is going to get something tomorrow that consumers here have had since the Great Depression. Deposit insurance, the coverage that kicks in if your bank runs into trouble. It's all about reassuring people that their money is safe. Here, anyway. In China, though, things are not always what you'd expect. Deposit insurance over there is supposed to make people nervous. Marketplace's Bree Benishore explains.
Deposit insurance reassures people their money will still be there if a bank goes bust, right? Well, the funny thing about China is that right now, nobody needs that reassurance.
Right now, everybody in China already assumes their deposits are 100% guaranteed.
Douglas Elliott is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Because the government and the Communist Party believe strongly in social stability.
That's called an implicit guarantee, and it is a problem. Baizhu Chen is professor at the Marshall School of Business.
The government does not want to have this extra financial burdens on them every time that the banks have some problems.
Another problem? Laziness. If banks know they'll get bailed out by the government, who cares what kinds of loans they're making?
When investors think all this stuff is implicitly guaranteed, nobody's doing credit analysis. Nobody's kicking the tires.
That's Jennifer Carpenter, associate professor at NYU Stern School of Business. So if people are already reassured they'll get bailed out, why have deposit insurance to reassure people that they'll get bailed out?
The role of deposit insurance is actually to tell people what's not insured.
Deposit insurance is a real thing with very clear limits. It only covers bank accounts of about $80,000 or less. It only applies to real banks. It takes away the vague expectation that the government will take care of everything. And it's part of something bigger in China.
The country is moving toward a market-based solution.
Again, Baizhu Chen at the Marshall School. Deposit insurance is just part of China's policy of slowly taking the training wheels off its financial system, allowing institutions to compete, even fail, but still having some kind of safety net, just not one that's too big. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The Kentucky Derby is this weekend, which I mention not because I follow horse racing super closely, but because all the dress-up makes it a big weekend for the folks at Rent the Runway, the company that lets women rent designer dresses and accessories instead of having to buy them and pay full freight. I also mention it because the company is featured in today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
When I was in New York City a couple of weeks ago, I took a quick trip over to Secaucus, New Jersey for a look inside Rent the Runway's big distribution center there. From the outside, a run-of-the-mill warehouse. On the inside, though, a combination dry cleaning plant, dress repair shop, and shipping facility. Big, huge piles of UPS envelopes filled, as it turned out, with rented dresses from the weekend before being returned to get ready for next weekend. CEO and co-founder Jen Hyman walked me around.
And the first step of the process is we scan the outside of each envelope, and it's a kind of binary scan. We either need those items today or we don't.
Because turning these things over is the name of the game, right?
Yeah.
You buy this garment one time, but if you rent it 30 times, all the more power to you.
Yeah, and you have to turn it around with essentially a zero-day turnaround time, because for our special events business, people are renting the runway for events that happen on a Saturday night. So when we get these garments back on a Monday or a Tuesday, they need to be at the next customer's house by that Thursday.
They're unpacking these envelopes and flinging these dresses around like they're nothing. And it occurs to me that the article here, the individual thing, becomes a commodity. It's your commodity.
It's certainly not. Each of these items is hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars a piece.
So is a barrel of oil.
This is an operation, and how we think about it is that each of these bins is actually coded for a different level of urgency.
So there's red bins, blue bins, more black bins. Those are all color-coded, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's all various levels of gotta go.
Yeah, so you see on the computer screen here, we've built all of this software from scratch that we need this Karman Mark Volvo size 10 dress. There's a mark there that says urgency.
And a big exclamation point.
And we checked it in. And the size 8 dress we don't need today.
Ah.
So we're going to prioritize dry cleaning the size 10 dress because we're going to match it up with another unit in the order.
On the way out. Give me the here's my brilliant idea elevator pitch that you came up with at Harvard Business School.
My idea at the time was that we should disrupt the way that women get dressed. So if you go into any woman's closet throughout the United States, you'll see that when you open the doors, most of the closet is black. It's filled with black dresses and black tops. Why is that? Is that because women's favorite color is black? No. It's because it's the most rational option.
Easiest, then right.
It's the easiest
goes with everything.
Option. And the whole point of Rent the Runway is to leave some of your common sense at home and actually try something printed or pink or sequined or fun just because you can.
And I'll tell you what, looking in these bins and there are, I mean, there's garments all over the place. I don't see a single black thing. There's flowers and spangles and yellows and pinks.
Spangles. That's
aren't those
an invented
aren't
word.
Those spangles?
This
what are those?
This is called a sequin.
Oh, all right. Well, come on.
I don't wear many sequins. That sounds very patriotic. I love that word.
Point being, there's all kinds of fun color here, no matter what you call it.
Now, interestingly, when women rent from brands that they've never tried or owned before, and they have these amazing experiences, and they take photographs, and they post them on Instagram, they develop positive association and love of that brand. And often, after Rent the Runway, they'll end up purchasing something from that brand.
Wow.
So this is a way for them to discover fashion.
Let's go to the dry cleaning thing. Is it true you guys are the biggest dry cleaner in the United States?
We are the biggest dry cleaner in the United States. I was actually just with the head of operations from Disney the other day, and he told me that Disney is the largest launderer, which makes sense. We're the largest dry cleaner.
How hard is it to get stuff through the cleaning cycle? I mean, you have a whole team of people who unpack them, they bust the stains. I mean, that's got to be a huge part of what goes on here.
Well, there's a lot of talent involved in deciphering how to clean something. Often it has to go through special care called spotting, where spotists are kind of chemists in a sense. You see all the chemicals that they have in front of them,
that
they assess what the stain is. They then mix chemicals together in order to get out that stain. And
it's
certainly
like a whole bunch of vials and
I know
he's
like potions and
that's crazy.
I mean, he's like a magician.
I have to go talk to the spotter guys.
Please
all right,
do.
All right. So he's using some air hose or something to get whatever that is on that thing. And as soon as he stops, I'm going to talk to him. Sir, can you tell me what you're doing?
It's called tamping. And what you're doing is you're taking the chemical and flushing it in and out between the fibers. You know, people think you're, you know, trying to beat that stain out, but what you're really trying to do is just get that chemical to flow back and forth between the fibers, and that's what breaks it up.
So when you look at a stain, do you know what you're going to do right away? You got a pretty good idea?
Pretty much. After 40 years, you can take a look at something and say, this is the way you have to go.
What's your success rate? Can you get everything out?
No, nobody can get everything out. You know, I feel I'm pretty successful, but nobody's perfect.
Thanks a lot for your time.
All right.
It's Nick the Stain Guy. What do your investors say when you say to them, I don't know what we're going to be a year from now? I mean, clearly you've got a strategic plan, but
this is going so fast. We're going to be 10 years from now, but a year is actually harder to predict than 10 years. Because we have a grand vision. I believe that every woman in this country and later every woman in the world should have a subscription to fashion, just like you have a subscription to music or to entertainment. And via that subscription, you would be able to just have fun with this amazing industry that we're in.
All right, so let's get to the checkout thing here. So somebody picks right? So, somebody picks all the clothes off a rack,
okay,
right?
Okay, so these, every single unit of inventory, we will slot it into a certain slot on a certain assembly bay.
Literally a slot where the hanger goes.
Yeah, and that's how we create the orders. And once we get it to a place where every unit in the order is here,
right,
we'll scan them all in, place it into the box.
And off it goes.
And off it goes.
Jen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jen Hyman, the CEO of Rent the Runway. It's kind of a crazy place, that warehouse is, so we took some pictures while we were out there. You can check them out at marketplace.org. Coming up.
The saying on the necklace appeared to me as a comforting promise from the page of a catalog.
The next installment of our series, The Transaction. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not really pretty. The Dow Industrial's off 1% today, 195 points, closed at 17,840. What is that? Is that like the sad clarinet? Is that what that is? The NASDAQ raced 1.6%, 82 points, finished at 4941. The S&P 500 slipped 1%. 21 points, closed at 2,085. For the month, yes, indeed, it is over. The Dow up 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 0.8%. The S&P 500 took home 0.9% today. But why not? Back to today. Tech stocks got pounded. Apple sliced off 2.75% today on news that a faulty component in the watch, the Apple Watch, would limit availability. Google sheared off 2%, but that was nothing compared to LinkedIn, which was down 2% at the bell, plunged more than 25% after hours. The company reported solid earnings, but its second quarter outlook was lousy, which is all anybody cares about. Really, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for March. U.S. automakers are slated to report April sales. The University of Michigan releases its final April consumer sentiment survey. And here's an opportunity to get half-dressed. Some folks celebrate No Pants Day. Not to be confused with No Pants Subway Ride Day, which takes place in January. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In New York City, a city that to some degree survives on takeout food, apps are replacing the telephone and paper menus as a way to place an order. Seamless is the biggest app in that space. Apologies for the jargon. But it so dominates online ordering that a lot of restaurants feel they are forced to do delivery by Seamless's rules. That could be changing, though. As Ilya Maritz reports from WNYC, billions of dollars are being invested in new online ordering systems.
You can literally see how popular Seamless is. Its red logo is everywhere, in restaurant windows, on plastic delivery bags, and on the vests of the guys who bring hot food to your door. But while Seamless really is seamless for customers to use, restaurants pay a high price in commission, up to 20% on each order. Yes, 20%. For Penelope, an American comfort food place in Midtown, it's just not worth it. Lucas Hasenstab is a co-owner.
The problem is that, you know, if it doesn't translate into more actual revenue or profit for us, then there's no upside to us. We're just working harder for less.
If you want to have Penelope's chicken meatballs delivered to your door, you can't do it through Seamless.
I have a hard time letting my friends use Seamless. I have, you know, a lot of people that are close to me signed on to the anti-Seamless movement.
Now, if you want to know why a restaurant would accept these high commissions, talk to Mike Vinoker. He's a co-founder of Burger Heights, a restaurant in Upper Manhattan which needed publicity when it opened last summer. Vinoker is showing me a spreadsheet.
I'm just going to eyeball this. So if you look at this Saturday night, which was our biggest night yet.
On this one Saturday night, 40% of Burger Heights' revenues came from orders placed online. And most of those orders came through Seamless and its partner Grubhub.
Maybe upward a third of our business could be through their service.
And that's Seamless and Grubhub's sweet spot. Abby Hunt is a company spokesperson. She's aware of the grumbling about high commissions, but she says for 30,000 restaurants from Boston to Chicago to L.A., getting listed is worth it.
Grubhub and Seamless together process more than 200,000 orders a day. So we're able to connect restaurateurs with people who wouldn't otherwise know that they exist.
Right now, Seamless and Grubhub look invincible. But that may be an illusion, according to Stephen Jacobs. He writes about e-commerce for the website Street Fight.
The reality is that these markets are changing extremely quickly.
Jacob says websites that already help people choose restaurants like Yelp and Google are now looking to help them order food. In February, Yelp bought an online ordering company, Eat24. And there are smaller upstarts doing weird and wacky things, like push for pizza.
Say that again.
I wish I had a button I could push for pizza.
Which had a hit with this video advertising one-button pizza ordering.
Wait. And it's just got one button on it.
And that one button...
Pizza.
Last year, according to one study, tech businesses focused on food attracted $2.4 billion in investment, a big increase from the previous year. In time, Jacob says, one or more of these companies will get popular and offer real competition to Seamless and Grubhub, and that in turn could bring down the hefty commissions that only a dominant player can demand.
I think it's in a way anathema to the very culture of the internet.
How will Seamless and Grubhub respond? They're already thinking about it. Spokesperson Abby Hunt says part of the answer is being a friend to restaurants.
And we actually have an in-house restaurant in our Chicago office and our New York office as well that helps put our employees in the shoes of the restaurateurs.
It's hard to say what app we'll be using to procure our pizzas and hot and sour soups even a year from now. But one thing's pretty clear. With more people ordering takeout online, restaurants will have to get used to working with the tech middlemen who now stand between them and their customers. In New York, I'm Ilya Meritz for Marketplace.
We've been asking for stories from you for a couple of months now. Stories about how a simple purchase affected your life in a special way. We've put a couple of them on the air for a series that we call The Transaction. Today's story is perhaps a little less about life being affected by a purchase and more about a purchase being affected by a life.
My name is Carol Thompson, and I live in Tyler, Texas. This is my husband's transaction story. Looking through a Signals catalog a couple of weeks before my birthday in 2008, I commented on a most special silver necklace in the catalog. "Look at this," I said to my husband, Ted. "I would love to have that necklace for my birthday," I told him. He said nothing, but I knew he felt the significance of the etching, "Heaven has in store what thou hast lost." Our precious daughter, Sarah, died in a 2005 pedestrian hit and run at the age of 24 years, bringing pain that I had no idea existed. Together, Ted and I were working hard to rebuild our lives. The saying on the necklace appeared to me as a comforting promise from the page of a catalog. Then came Good Friday, March 21st, 2008. We made plans to eat dinner out with special friends, Roger and Belinda, who were coming to pick us up at our home. We had spoken on the phone, planning to get hamburgers at Whataburger. How very quickly everything changes from moment to moment. When Roger and Belinda drove up, sirens were screaming up the street. Between the end of the phone call and the arrival of our friends, Ted's heart gave out and he was gone. Easter Sunday and my birthday came 2 days later. We usually celebrated Easter with family in Waco, Texas, but there was nothing usual about this Easter. Now we were all planning Ted's memorial service. Following Ted's funeral, I was going through the mail that was stacking up on the table. Among the magazines, catalogs, and bills, I found a small white cardboard box. It was my silver promise. I read again and again, "Heaven has in store what thou hast lost," etched in the birthday necklace that Ted had ordered, never saying a word. Ted's the only person I've ever known who managed to have a birthday present delivered after he was gone. It was very meaningful and lifted my heart. I could picture Ted standing next to Sarah. That was my piece.
Take a minute and tell us your story, a transaction that changed something for you. There's a spot you can do that at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today. I know I was a bit rough on Microsoft yesterday, said they didn't do anything cool anymore. Well, it's amazing what a difference a day can make, huh? Next time you're in front of a computer, do me a favor and go to how-old.net. That's how-old.net. It's a facial recognition thing that Microsoft is working on. You upload a picture of yourself, and it tells you how old it thinks you are. I tried it with a couple of pictures of me, and let's just say I really, really, really like the results. We've put them up on our website, some of those pictures. It's marketplace.org. Check it out. Of course, there's no guarantees. You might not like the picture so much. You might not. John Buckley, Kate Concannon, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.